Let's go ahead and take our seats. Last session before we get to cocktails later. I'm Elizabeth Slattery. I'm with Pacific Legal Foundation, and I'm a member of the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group Executive Committee. And I'm here to introduce the moderator for this session. This is the continued independence of the judiciary, which is a very timely topic. So moderating this session is the Honorable James C. Ho. Judge Ho serves on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Before taking the bench in 2018, he was a partner at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. An experienced appellate litigator, Judge Ho argued dozens of cases in the federal and state courts and won, is it three cases at the Supreme Court? He served as Solicitor General of Texas, Chief Counsel for the Senate Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on the Constitution in both the Civil Rights Division and Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice, and as a law clerk to Judge Jerry Smith on the Fifth Circuit and Justice Clarence Thomas. Judge Ho has spoken often about the need for lawyers to have courage of their convictions, and the same goes for judges. In a speech earlier this year, he said the judiciary should not change its rules to avoid criticism or in response to political pressure. Quote, if you're afraid of being booed, then you shouldn't be a judge. If you're going to do this job, then you should do it for public service, not public applause, end quote. So with that, I will turn it over to Judge Jim Ho.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. I am honored to moderate today's discussion. The title of our panel is The Continued Independence of the Judiciary. I think there are two ways to have this discussion, and I think it depends on which decade you think this is. And I say that because I've been coming to these conventions for over 25 years, and over that time, I've witnessed a radical change in how cultural and academic elites talk about the judiciary. In past decades, when anyone would complain about a Supreme Court decision that they didn't like and agitated for some kind of judicial reform, like jurisdiction stripping, term limits, judicial elections, or other ideas, the voices of elite reason would always intone about the importance of judicial independence and the need to shield the judiciary from politics. And we all dutifully agreed. That was the governing consensus. We all accepted that if you don't like certain rulings, fine, go win some elections so that you can appoint different judges. But you don't mess with judicial independence just because you don't like a particular decision. That's what we were all told. And that's what folks did. Folks said that an originalist judiciary was their goal, and certainly nothing to be afraid of, because an originalist judiciary simply does what the people tell it to do through their beloved constitution and through the laws they elect legislators to enact. To put it simply, an originalist judiciary is not a sword, it's a mirror. If you believe in democracy, if you believe in your fellow Americans, then you should believe in originalism. By contrast, if you think that the views of half the country are garbage, then no, you're not going to like originalism. But now let's fast forward to the current conversation. If you listen to commentary coming from academic and cultural elites today, the message is simple. The judiciary is no longer to be trusted. Well, I think that gets things exactly backwards. I think the real message we should draw is that academic and cultural elites are no longer to be trusted to talk about the judiciary. We've all seen how the recent attacks on the Supreme Court and the judiciary generally are based on a series of double standards. But be sure not to miss the important part. The double standards aren't inadvertent. They're intentional. It's a deliberate strategy to create a perverse incentive structure for judges. If you rule the way the critics dictate, you won't be criticized. You'll be celebrated. But if you don't, you'll be ostracized. You'll be defamed and destroyed with every tool that they have. And they have many tools: the academy, the media, even the Judicial Conference of the United States. The double standards don't trouble the critics, because to the critics, this isn't a debate. It's a war. And that's the choice I think we all have to make as we approach these conversations. We can either treat this as a debate, or we can treat this as a war on the judiciary. At least that's my take. Fortunately, the Federalist Society has put together an all-star panel to share their views on judicial independence, and I hope and believe we will have a very engaging and interesting discussion. With us today are Canon Shanmugam, partner at Paul Weiss, Rifkind, Wharton, and Garrison, Daniel Epps, professor of law at the Washington University in St. Louis, Stephen Vladek, professor of law at the University of Texas at Austin.
No, Georgetown.
I'll take the football team.
I was going to say, I thought you were going to Georgetown, but the information I got was UT, so you'll clarify. All right. You can clarify for Wes. And finally, my distinguished colleague on the Fifth Circuit, the Honorable Edith Jones. I'm going to ask each of our panelists to give some introductory remarks, followed by a panel discussion. And we will, of course, be sure to leave time for questions from the audience. Canon, could you kick us off?
Sure. Thank you very much, Judge Ho. It's a real privilege to be with all of you today to speak about this very important topic. And it is really a privilege to serve on this panel with Judge Jones, who is a legend of the federal judiciary, Judge Ho, whom I've been proud to call a friend since our very first days in Washington together, and two professors whom I greatly admire, Professor Epps and Professor Vladek. And thank you, of course, to the Federalist Society for inviting me. Well, 2 months ago, I gave a talk on this very topic at Duke Law School, focusing on the recent attacks on the Supreme Court's legitimacy. That talk got a little bit of attention, and some of you may have read or listened to it already. So I'm not going to repeat all of the points I made there again today. Instead, I just want to briefly summarize a few key points and then offer some additional observations in light of recent events. My basic thesis was and is that the recent attacks on the court's legitimacy are unfounded. But more than that, I believe that they are dangerous, undermining public confidence in the court and imperiling the rule of law. Now, as I said in my speech, the recent criticisms of the court, I think, fall into three primary categories. First, critics have attacked the way that the current court is constituted, really focusing on the events following the death of Justice Scalia in 2016 and the death of Justice Ginsburg in 2020. Those critics argued that the Senate acted improperly in each instance, first by refusing to act on a nomination for Justice Scalia's successor until after the 2016 election, and then by acting quickly to confirm Justice Ginsburg's successor before the 2020 election. In my view, that criticism lacks merit for the simple reason that the Senate has the power to act as it chooses when it comes to judicial nominations, and the Senate has exercised that power quite muscularly at various points in our nation's history. It is this criticism that has led to proposals for so-called structural reform in the form of changes to the court's composition. But perhaps not accidentally, those proposals, for the most part, seem designed not to address deeper structural concerns, but rather simply to affect the makeup of the current court. While those proposals will now thankfully recede in the wake of last week's election, they reflect a desire to promote short-term interests about the outcomes of particular cases over long-term interests about the proper functioning of the court as an institution. Second, critics have attacked the way that the current court is deciding cases, with the suggestion that the court is somehow not doing law, but instead acting as a group of politicians in robes. But again, this criticism seems based simply on dissatisfaction with particular outcomes the court is reaching. President Trump deserves enormous credit for his three appointees to the court, as for his many outstanding appointees to the lower courts. But those appointees are not monolithic. It is striking that last year, the three justices who voted together the most often were not President Trump's appointees, but rather the court's three Democratic appointees, who voted together in 90% of the court's cases. In fact, the emerging narrative of the current court is not of some monolithic partisan majority marching in lockstep, but rather of disagreements about how far and how fast to take the now prevailing originalist and textualist approaches to constitutional and statutory interpretation. And while there is no doubt that the current court is reaching outcomes that more often, though not always, please conservatives, it simply does not follow that the justices are somehow less independent. So again, I think this criticism also misses the mark. Now, third, critics have argued that the court is acting unethically, with particularly close scrutiny of some of the court's Republican appointees. As a preliminary matter, many of those allegations are transparently insubstantial. Witness the recent claim that there was something nefarious about a justice and his wife attending a concert with a German princess whom the New York Times described as eccentric, surely a badge of honor. But more broadly, the fundamental premise of this line of criticism is that the court is somehow not subject to any ethical rules. And that was simply incorrect even before the court's recent adoption of a code of conduct. And in my view, in order to make the case that the court is somehow acting corruptly, critics bear the burden of showing, at a minimum, that the court's members have been intentionally violating applicable rules. That is a high burden, and I do not believe that the critics have met it. It is one thing to argue that the court should adopt new ethical rules going forward. I believe that the court has already made positive changes that will help to ensure greater transparency. But it is quite another to suggest that members of the court have been flouting the existing rule. And it is hard to escape the conclusion that critics' real beef, in many of these cases, is with the outcomes the current court is reaching and with the particular justices who are responsible. As I discussed in my talk at Duke, I believe these criticisms of the court's legitimacy are unfounded. But I do also believe that they are more than that, that they are affirmatively dangerous as well. Attacks on the court's legitimacy are not new, but this time around they have been accompanied by unusually toxic rhetoric with two deeply concerning effects. First, attacks on the court's legitimacy are contributing to the threat of violence against and a broader culture of harassment of the court's members. We have already seen the attempted assassination of one member of the court and threats against many others. And second, attacks are undermining public confidence in the court and imperiling the rule of law. What the rule of law connotes is that we live in a society where all of us adhere to the law, including judicial decision. In my view, the greatest threat to the rule of law is the perception, fed by the court's critics, that the justices are simply politicians in robes, that the judiciary is not a neutral forum for adjudicating disputes according to objective legal principles, but rather a third political branch, with law simply being politics by another means. Finally, I have spoken both at Duke and elsewhere about the role of the legal academy in engaging deeply with the work of the court. I fear that many in the academy, with the notable exception of present company, are not particularly interested in that sort of engagement. Indeed, the legal academy seems to be at risk of devolving into what I described as an echo chamber of grievance when it comes to the court, with too many simply dismissing the court out of hand. The problem is certainly not helped by the makeup of the faculty at top law schools, where one can usually count the number of conservative faculty members on one hand with fingers left over. Nor is it helped by a growing intolerance on the left toward conservative legal positions, even when those positions have become the law of the land. If tomorrow's lawyers are not being taught about the work of the court properly and even-handedly, if they see their professors not modeling respect for the law, but rather simply purveying snark on social media and elsewhere, the legitimacy not just of the court, but of our entire legal system will continue to be undermined. I want to offer, in closing, just a few additional observations in light of last week's elections. First, whatever the long-term effects of the attacks on the court's legitimacy, it is clear that they had no meaningful impact on the election. In fact, it is striking just how small of a role the Supreme Court played in the campaign, even though it was the first presidential election since the Supreme Court's decision in Dobbs. Of course, the court's makeup ultimately depends on the outcomes of presidential elections. But having arguably been the dispositive factor in tipping the 2016 election to President Trump, the court does not seem to have registered in this one. The most logical inference is that a majority of Americans do not appear to have been dissatisfied with the general direction, much less the legitimacy, of the current Supreme Court. Second, as I have noted, I urge the Legal Academy in my Duke speech to engage more directly with the work of the court. In that regard, the early returns since the election are not promising. It appears that the primary effect of the election on the Legal Academy has been to cause professors to quit Twitter in search of new platforms, such as Blue Sky or something called Spoutable, where they can find like-minded people and avoid encountering people with whom they disagree. That is precisely what I warned about in my speech, that the left is simply withdrawing from the intellectual battlefield into a walled fortress. And while they are certainly free to do so, I believe that it will leave all of us worse off. Finally, in an editorial on my Duke speech, the Wall Street Journal expressed the hope that other veteran Supreme Court advocates would follow suit and speak out about the attacks on the court's legitimacy. Perhaps they have been deterred by the reaction to my speech, where some cantankerous critics attacked me for acting out of self-interest in defending the court as a regular practitioner there. My actual self-interest is in having a quiet life. But to the best of my knowledge, not one veteran Supreme Court advocate has followed suit and spoken up, even though a number, both on the right and on the left, have expressed their agreement with me in private. I would be lying if I said I'm surprised, but I am disappointed. Then again, we live at a time when courage seems to be in short supply. Thank you, and I look forward to our discussion.
Thank you. Professor Epps?
Is this on? All right, thanks very much, Judge Ho. I'm excited to be here at this convention for the first time. I've done a few events with the Federal Society where I've sort of played the role of the late Alan Colmes over the years, and I've run into a bunch of old friends, each of whom has said, what are you doing here? I have to confess, it's not the place in the world I'd most want to be 9 days after the election, but it has been fun to get to see some of my friends react in real time to the announcement of the distinguished nominee for Attorney General. Seriously, though, it's great to be on this panel. It's a fantastic panel, and it's particularly great to have the chance to tell my good friend Cannon, he's wrong about everything. So, not everything. What I want to engage with is what Cannon said about proposals over recent years to change or reform the court, given that I'm someone who has been active in those debates. And that topic, you know, may, as Cannon suggested, may seem a little irrelevant, given that there's no prospect of any kind of reform like that in the near term. I nonetheless think that thinking through these questions is important because it can help us understand what might be wrong with current arrangements, which I think is a little bit more complicated than Cannon's story suggests. So I think it's hard to dispute Cannon's case that there's a clear ideological valence to proposals to change how the court's membership is selected, to change its powers and so on, and various other kinds of reforms. But there's also an ideological valence to defending the currently constituted court. And whenever we think seriously about changing underlying structural arrangements in our government, whether it's abolition of the Electoral College or repeal of the 17th Amendment, someone's ox is going to be gored. The status quo always benefits one side, and that doesn't mean we shouldn't ask whether there are reasons to change things or whether alternate arrangements might be better. And I do think there are reasons to think that the current structure is imperfect, that are separable from a bare desire to hope that the court votes differently in big cases, even if that plays a big role in motivating participants in those debates. And in fact, I think those arguments are important precisely because judicial independence is important. And the premise of my argument is that having an independent court is important because we really do need an institution that's capable of definitively resolving some of the disputes that divide us most as a nation. The court will never be able to make everyone happy in some of those deep disputes. But ideally, what we want is a court that can produce results that even those who dislike the results can live with and accept. And in doing that, what's critical for the court is its legitimacy. As my colleague in the political science department at my university, James Gibson, puts it, legitimacy is for losers. But legitimacy is not an objective truth, right? It's a sociological fact about what people in society believe. Do they trust the court? Do they respect it? And I think it's undeniable that defined that way, the court has lost some of its legitimacy in recent years. The very fact that smart people like Cannon have to go around denying that the court is illegitimate actually kind of proves the point sociologically. Now, of course, much of that decline I take Cannon's point that this is not did not cause a shift in the outcome of the presidential election, but there's certainly been a decline if you look at public opinion polls and things like that. Some of that is the result of arguments and rhetoric that partisan political actors are making. And so one response to that is to do what Cannon is doing and try to persuade people that the critiques are wrong. I don't think that is going to ultimately solve the problem because I see the attacks on the court as not necessarily the underlying cause, but maybe symptoms of a deeper problem. And my argument is that the basic design of the court, however much sense it may have once made, is starting to strain as a result of a number of developments in American history over time, and until we address that, things are going to get worse, and I think the outlook for judicial legitimacy and independence is perhaps not great. And so here are the factors I see as contributing to the problem. So first, justices have life tenure, and vacancies are unpredictable as they arise from a combination of deaths and strategic retirements. Second, justices serve for longer and longer periods. Their typical length of service crept up significantly in the latter part of the 20th century, with average tenure starting to approach three decades, and that seems to only be continuing. Third, the court is very small, only nine justices. Smaller court means fewer vacancies, and any one appointment is far more consequential. Fourth, the court is incredibly powerful in a way that it wasn't at the outset of the American Republic. Its prestige and authority have grown tremendously, and it is now expected to and does weigh in on almost every major government action of consequence. And finally, and most importantly, we live in a highly and increasingly polarized age. Political parties and voters are more polarized than they've ever been. And we have a deeply polarized legal culture as well. I'm not here to blame the Federalist Society for that, but surely this convention is evidence that there are two legal universes. And presidents know this and make sure to choose nominees from their preferred legal universe. And I think there's reason to think that the ideological distance between parties, political parties, is increasing, both and the ideological distance between our legal cultures may be increasing as well. And the end of the Senate filibuster has removed one potentially moderating effect on nominee selection. So if you combine those facts, life tenure, court small size, tendency of justices to remain on the court longer. That means vacancies are relatively rare. They're unpredictable because justices choose to retire strategically and others choose to remain on the court until death. But those unpredictable events are extremely consequential because of the court's power and because our polarized political and legal cultures produce justices who decide cases quite differently depending on the legal universe that they come from and the party of the president who appointed them. And we have a court today where judicial ideology tracks party of appointment more than at any point in American history. Recognizing this point is not the same thing as saying the justices decide cases in an entirely political or partisan fashion or saying that anyone is acting in bad faith. As this panel and this audience surely knows, many of the cases, court's cases are unanimous. Many of the non-unanimous cases do not neatly break down on party lines. But I think few people familiar with the court's work would deny that the party of the appointing president matters for judicial ideology. Nor would they deny that ideology matters in a great deal of, or matters a great deal in many of the cases with the highest stakes. Okay. And I see this as creating a problem for legitimacy because the shape of the court, the resulting shape of the court, is hard to justify. Individual appointments to the court are immensely consequential, and strategic retirements and Senate obstructionism can mean that filling any given vacancy can leave that seat in one party's hands for more than a generation. This means that in our system, the composition of the court bears only an imperfect relationship to the results of elections. Accordingly, some presidents have much more influence on the court's membership than others. Even though Democrats controlled the White House for 24 of the last 56 years, happenstance and other factors mean that Democrats have appointed only five justices during that time, while Republicans have had 15 appointments plus one, moving one justice to the chief justiceship. The reason that matters comes back to judicial legitimacy and ultimately to judicial independence. One side of the country looks at the structural arrangements and sees the system as unfairly rigged. And according to empirical research that I and some co-authors have done, there's a realistic chance that there will not be a majority on the court of justices on the court appointed by Democratic presidents at any point in the next century. Half the country, and surely more than half of this room, may think that's great. But for those that don't, they're increasingly going to see a system in which only one party gets to staff the majority of the court as illegitimate and not worthy of their respect. And frankly, I think this system for divvying up appointments on the court is pretty indefensible. And more generally, the path of the law and the resolution of the questions that most divide our country should not turn on events like whether Ruth Bader Ginsburg's cancer causes her to die in September of 2020 or if she survives for a few more months. And so we can continue arguing about whether the court is or isn't legitimate. I'm not particularly invested in the underlying question. My observation is just that as a sociological effect, a number of people believe that, and the court is not legitimate and probably are increasingly likely to do so, and that arguments like canons are not going to produce consensus. They're not going to persuade the losing side to just accept what they see as defeat for generations. And so until we become willing to really address some of these structural problems, I see things as likely to get worse before they get better. And so if you care about the court and judicial independence more generally, you should be interested in thinking about ways to prevent that from happening.
Thank you, Professor Vladek.
Thanks. So let me just say, I thought that by leaving Texas, I was getting away from the Fifth Circuit. Apparently, I failed. So it seems to me that the courts, and the Supreme Court in particular, depend upon the elected branches of government to a far greater degree than we tend to admit. This is true both on the front end, with respect to all of the ways in which courts are given the power and the ability to rule on cases, and, of course, on the back end, with respect to all of the ways in which courts' rulings and their judgments are put into effect. It's why, in Federalist 78, Hamilton was so adamant that the judiciary would be the least dangerous branch, not because it was unimportant, not because it would be unindependent, but because it would be both independent and dependent. This understanding has, I think, two sets of implications with respect to any contemporary conversation about judicial independence. The first is that the judicial independence idea itself depends upon tons of support from the elected branches of government. To take perhaps the most elementary example, the Supreme Court's budget request for FY 2024 was $151 million. 2% of that total, roughly $3 million, covers the nine justices' salaries, which Article 3 of the Constitution protects against diminution. But that means that 98% of the Supreme Court's requested budget comes from appropriations not mandated by the Constitution. And if we expand that out to the entire federal judiciary, the total budget request for FY 2024 was $9.9 billion, again, with a tiny fraction of that comprising the constitutionally required compensation for active Article III judges. There are, of course, political reasons why Congress tends to give the federal judiciary most, if not all, of what it wants, but the Constitution, even as it enshrines judicial independence, does not require that result. And historically, Congress has used its powers not just over the purse, as levers over the court in lots of other ways too, controlling everything from when the court sits, including not at all in 1802, to where it sits in the Capitol until 1935, to how many justices there are, to which cases the court hears, including getting rid of jurisdiction over pending cases, to the means by which the court hears these cases, to whether and when the justices can receive retirement benefits, and so on. My favorite example is a one-paragraph January 1882 statute, which, and I'm paraphrasing, but I don't think you will dispute this paraphrase if you read it, basically said, quote, "Dear Justice Ward Hunt, if you retire in the next 30 days, we will give you a pension. Love, Congress." Hunt, of course, obliged. And the larger point, right, to my knowledge, no one ever seriously argued that any of those statutes, reforming the court, nudging the court, controlling the court, were unconstitutional insofar as they infringed upon judicial independence. Likewise, as Hamilton argued, and as by now familiar sledding, the courts depend upon the executive branch to have their judgments enforced. You may not be familiar with Rule 45.1 of the Supreme Court's rules, but it provides that the court's formal mandates are issued not in the name of the justices, but in the name of the President of the United States. Again, there are political reasons why presidents have overwhelmingly enforced or abided by judgments, even those to which they object, but that's high constitutional politics, not constitutional law. The second related implication is that maintaining broad public support, as Dan talked about, for the courts as a whole and the Supreme Court in particular, is thereby essential to maintaining judicial independence, not because courts can't be independent without public support, but because that independence just won't matter in a world in which no one has to listen to whatever the courts choose to say. Whether or not President Andrew Jackson actually said in response to Worcester versus Georgia that John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it, the point is the same. The Supreme Court circa 1832 just didn't have the political capital to force Jackson's hand. It wasn't that the Supreme Court of John Marshall's era lacked independence. It was that it lacked the kind of broad, diffuse public credibility that, for example, gave political force to the legal judgments of the Warren Court 125 years later. This is why I'm skeptical of many contemporary calls for unbridled judicial courage. If your mantra is to let justice be done though the heavens fall, what happens in the second case when the heavens fell after the first one? The point is not, as it's often caricatured by those attacking reform proposals, that the political branches can do whatever they want to the courts. Not only has the Supreme Court correctly held otherwise, but I'm one of the staunchest academic defenders of the view that Article III itself would bar Congress from using its myriad authorities over the courts to purport to exercise judicial power for itself, like a statute that conditioned the court's discretionary appropriations on overruling Dobbs. Rather, the point is more modest. Court reforms are not per se a threat to judicial independence, and indeed many court reforms might even bolster that independence insofar as they're aimed at increasing judicial accountability and thereby enhancing public faith in the judiciary. An inspector general who had no power to discipline the justices but who could publicly report on their behavior is not a threat to judicial independence. Congress taking more control over the Supreme Court's docket, which it completely controlled from the founding until 1891, is not a threat to judicial independence. And Congress asserting more control over where lawsuits are filed, including, for example, limiting the ability of litigants, Democrats, Republicans, or Cardassians, to handpick individual district judges, is not a threat to judicial independence. This brings me to the second line of emerging criticism, which we've already heard this afternoon, that critiques such as mine are illegitimate because they are themselves seeking to delegitimize the judiciary. Justice Alito kicked this off in his September 2021 speech at Notre Dame, where in calling me and others out by name, he argued that even the term shadow docket, quote, feeds unprecedented efforts to intimidate the court and to damage it as an independent institution, unquote. There are, of course, elements of this charge in Cannon's Duke speech and his comments today. And most recently, my friend and Case Western Law professor Jonathan Adler suggested on Tuesday that for Supreme Court critics like me, who are now flagging the difficulties the court will face in standing up to a second-term President Trump, quote, this could be a case of chickens coming home to roost, unquote. I certainly agree that there are some critics of the Supreme Court who have sought, through their criticisms, to weaken the court as an institution, whether as such or through reforms designed to make it easier for Democrats to reassert partisan control over the court, reforms that would have onerous long-term consequences for the court's credibility in the other direction. It's why, among other things, I have always opposed expanding the court. But there have been a bunch of contemporary criticisms of the Supreme Court specifically and the lower courts more generally that have been far more nuanced, driven by institutional rather than partisan considerations. Focusing on the most superficial critiques and responding only to them is necessarily picking at the lowest hanging fruit and refusing to acknowledge, let alone grapple with, more substantial responses. Now, I can't speak for others, but my focus all along has been on how the court's own behavior has contributed to this erosion in public support. If my descriptive summaries of that behavior have been inaccurate, I'm all ears. If the substance of my criticisms of that behavior is misplaced, ditto. If my accounting of all of the ways in which litigants have taken advantage of judge shopping is factually inaccurate, then maybe instead of taking a clumsy personal shot in a judicial opinion, explain why that research and the arguments based upon it are wrong. But if we're not going to engage with whether those descriptions are accurate or whether their content is correct or even legitimate, it seems to me that we're just shouting past each other. In the process, we fail to get at the underlying issue, which in my view is why it is a problem for the Supreme Court and the federal courts writ large that their credibility is declining and has declined from the perspective of a significant percentage of the American people, even if not of the people in this room. We're never going to agree on how to fix that problem. This is, we're not going to agree on exactly what caused that decline in the first place. But to pretend that it isn't a problem in the first place, or that it's a problem caused only by those who have identified it as a problem, is, I respectfully submit, to bury our heads in the sand. And by the time we pull our heads out and look around, we may not recognize the federal judiciary that's left, not because it is no longer independent, but because it is so independent that no one listens to it anymore. Thank you very much.
Thank you to both professors. Judge Jones.
Thank you, Judge Ho. Professor Bladick has left the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit is happy to announce that Professor Bladick will soon be criticizing the Ninth Circuit and the D.C. Circuit, where I believe many initiatives of the Trump administration will find an immediate litigating home and a federal judiciary that is at least 90% appointed by presidents whose appointments have not been criticized. I hope to respond here today in defense of my colleagues, Fifth Circuit District Judges, who came under relentless attacks during the last several years by certain professors, including notably Professor Bladick, for what he considers close to unethical situations in litigation which have existed since the dawn of judging. Ever since there were two judges, somebody would want to be in front of one judge rather than another. As someone said right before our panel, this goes back to the Garden of Eden. in Texas, many of you don't know what's been going on, but we have four districts. Some of them are 500 miles wide, 200 or 300 miles deep. They may have one major municipal area, and the judges have to cover courthouses that are several hundred miles away. So they have done this in a legitimate fashion, according to federal law. I think it's 28 U.S.C. 371, that says that each district court has the right to divide up its docket. As a result of this, back in the 1970s, there was one judge in Tyler, Texas, named William Wayne Justice. And the government and the ACLU liked to file suit in Tyler, Texas, because William Wayne Justice was the arbiter of the constitutional law. In fact, after he rose to sainthood on the bench, he would be interviewed by, 60 Minutes or something and saying, "I'm just a servant of the Constitution." And in that role, he ran the Texas prison system, the Texas mental health and retardation system, the Texas juvenile justice system, and when he tried to take over the Texas education system, the Fifth Circuit finally said that was maybe a bridge too far. That is what you call judge picking. Did we hear members of the academia or members of the Bar Association saying, Judge, it created an appearance of impropriety that all of these people were suddenly locating their cases in Texas. No, we did not. Only a month ago, a federal district judge in Maryland issued a ruling about application of the Endangered Species Act that is regarded by the, at least according to the press, the oil and gas industry, fears that it could completely undermine exploration for oil and gas. Where? The Gulf of Mexico. Now, why would the Sierra Club sue the U.S. government in Baltimore, the Chesapeake Bay, about species in the Gulf of Mexico? Well, there are 13 district judges in Baltimore. Only one was appointed by a Republican judge. Now, the odds are pretty good of getting a favorable venue if all you look at is who appointed the judge. Professor Vladek has relentlessly, he talks about the decline in the view of the judiciary. Well, I hasten to point out that when he was filing his complaints, his articles, his amicus brief, his tweets, calling out by name, started out with Judge Kaczmarek, went to Judge Reed O'Connor, later on included Judge Mark Pittman, Judge Cam Barker, Judge Jeremy Kernodle. That's an awful lot of single judges, I might add. But he singled them all out for criticism, and yet the actual litigators in that case, which was often the U.S. government, did not move to change venue. They did not move to recuse these judges under 455 or some other rubric. They did not even question the judge's integrity. Judge Drew Tipton, in fact, one of the main targets of criticism, ruled for the state of Texas and against the U.S. government four times, but he ruled against the state of Texas two times. And yet there's an overwhelming sense of impropriety that these cases are being filed in particular districts. Well, Judge Professor Vladek had allies and people who took the lead or in response to his ongoing critique, and they are Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Senator Schumer, and so on. And they came forward with proposals. Oh, my God, this is the worst thing in the world. And this prompted a response, which I'll mention later. But the point is that when you are criticizing the judiciary, as Judge Ho said, not on the basis of what the substance of the rulings was, and by the way, many of them were upheld by the Fifth Circuit, which Professor Vladek, I guess, were just as bad too, although a few, but not all, were reversed by the Supreme Court. When you're not criticizing on the ground of the legal reasoning and analysis, then you've got some other purpose in mind for the criticism. And clearly the senators had another purpose in mind for their criticism. Professor Vladek is not the only person who's attacking the judiciary today. Cannon mentioned this as well. You also have an exploitation of the judicial complaint process. And it's interesting how those complaints are filed. I read in the paper, for instance, Judge Eileen Cannon had over 1,000 judicial misconduct complaints filed against her. Judge Ho, Judge Lisa Branch, Judge Vaden in the Sixth Circuit, Judge Pryor in the 11th Circuit, all have had judicial misconduct complaints against them. I've been the target of a complaint, but that was a long time ago. They're very distracting to a judge. They can be filed by anybody, any member of, as you see on the case of the people attacking Judge Ho and Judge Branch. They can be filed by any person. There is no statute of limitations. There are very rigid procedural rules. More recently, there's a complaint from within the judiciary about my friend and fellow person in baby judge school named Judge Pauline Newman, who's here with us today. And Judge Newman's experience can show you just how far off base or how difficult the judicial complaint process can become for people. But in addition to that, you have fake ethics scandals. One of our judges, Judge Willett, was targeted because he owned $600 in a child's college fund of some bank stock. Well, the bank was not a litigant in the case, which would have forced immediate recusal. The bank wasn't even in the amicus brief of some banking organization. But oddly enough, the press had looked through his financial disclosure statement, and oddly enough, within 2 hours of when the press called Judge Willett's chambers and said, should he recuse, the DOJ suddenly changed its complaint to list that particular bank as a party, quote, in interest, although not involved in the case. Something's going on here, and it's very unsavory. Attacks on the judiciary, I fully agree with the others, are ultimately attacks on the rule of law, because when you say that the judges are all acting out of impure motives because they were appointed by a certain judge, remember, only a few years ago, President Trump was called on the carpet by the Chief Justice himself for talking about Obama judges. Well, now we're getting the same thing from the left about judges who were appointed by President Trump. In a better world, the judiciary would be defended by the ABA, the ALI, the local bar associations, the patent bar, and even by members of the academic community. Why are they silent? Even in the worst, and I would say the worst, many would not, of the excesses of the Warren Court, when I was a child and bumper stickers were rife in Texas to impeach Earl Warren, there were many prominent academic critics who didn't like what found the questionable the Warren Court decisions, but at least they went after those on the basis of legal reasoning and legal analysis. I'm sorry that's not happening today. So it's often said that a fight between a lawyer and a judge is not a fair fight. But normally, this is the first opportunity I've had to speak up on behalf of my fellow judges in the district courts of the Fifth Circuit, because it is not a fair fight for those who have a podium, an unregulated podium in the press and the law blogs and so on, that they can use to cast these illegitimate aspersions. And finally, I want to say a couple remarks about the judiciary as an institution. I'm somewhat disappointed in the fact that as an institution, the judiciary seems to be eager to compromise and concede points about illegitimacy that it shouldn't, in my view. And someone had pointed out, I can't remember which one it was, but anyway, the 2 points in particular recently, there is currently a measure winding its way through the rules process to require the filers of amicus brief to disclose the parties who supported filing those amicus briefs. In other words, who paid the money? Why is that? That is so various groups who are opposed to certain members of the judiciary and the judicial system can expose the Koch brothers. They can expose whoever supports the Alliance Defending Freedom. They can expose any right-wing, the National Civil Liberties Alliance, and its members. They can dox them, they can harass them, they can say, oh, that judge was at such and such a meeting with those people. Therefore, there's an air of impropriety. I'm so sorry to say that the federal judiciary is allowing this to go through the rules-making process. I urge any of you who are defenders of the First Amendment, it's a case called NAACP v. Alabama, which says that that violates the First Amendment, that kind of compelled disclosure. The one other point I'd make is single-judge districts. In an effort to comply, the institutional judiciary came out with this strange idea to jury-rig the assignment of cases in federal district courts, and within 24 to 48 hours, they had to retract that because they forgot one thing. The law says it's the district courts. It is the district courts under statute who decide this allocation. It is not a rulemaking function of the higher reaches of the judiciary. And I'll conclude by pointing out that the judiciary was challenged on both of these efforts by very important letters written by Senator McConnell. By the way, McConnell of FEC v. McConnell, dark money in politics, you know, all that, which is a big deal now from a First Amendment standpoint, who had to remind the judiciary of what the Constitution and the law provide and remind the judiciary that it is, as Professor Vladeck conceded while he's complaining about judges in single-judge courthouses, he understands it's the law that Congress can change if he can lobby them to do that. But for all these reasons, I'm a defender of our judges and the integrity of our judges, whether they were appointed by President Trump or President Reagan or President Bush or even Presidents Biden and Obama. And I hope that maybe we could put some spine in the ABA and the ALI. I don't have high hopes for that. Maybe we can change academia. I think at some point it will have to do so. But for the meantime, this is my only opportunity to speak up for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Jones. As we promised, four extremely engaging and interesting presentations. I'll just say I will be shocked if nobody wants to respond to another member of the panel.
Well, I'll go first, though I don't think I have Article III standing to speak to what is going on in Texas, so I'll leave that to current or former residents. I want to say just a couple of things in response to Dan and Steve's very thoughtful comments. Dan obviously focused on the issue of structural reforms, and he made the point that things are somewhat different today from what they were at the time of the founding. And, you know, he listed a number of factors. Some of them, I think, actually are the same. Justices have always had life tenure. Vacancies have always been unpredictable. I'm minded of the fact that the only reason we got John Marshall was because John Jay turned down the chance to be Chief Justice for a second time. The court is very small, but it always has been. It was even smaller at the time of the founding. And as for the fact that we live in a really polarized era, I'm reminded of a remarkable fact I came across when I was preparing for my Duke speech, thanks to the wonderful Penn State historian Rachel Sheldon, who pointed out to me that when John Tyler was president from 1844 to 1845, he had 8 nominations to the Supreme Court rejected by the Senate, really pretty much solely on the ground that he was a Whig and they were Democrats, and the Democrats did not like the Whigs, and they particularly did not like John Tyler. And the amazing thing was that those 8 nominations were 4 people, so he put up the same people multiple times and they got rejected, but more on that another day. I do think that Dan, though, is correct that there are some things that are a bit different. We are living longer. The court is, I think, deciding seemingly every major issue in American life. That has been true even before the recent changes in the court's membership, and it has continued. So I think that there is something of a bipartisan valence to that. But the Supreme Court undoubtedly plays a bigger role in American life than it did 20 or 40 or 60 years ago. And we have seen retirements seemingly becoming more strategic, not just on the Supreme Court level, but on the level of the lower courts as well. And I think I would acknowledge all of those things. And I would acknowledge, therefore, that some of the arguments for structural reforms are not without force. I think that there are respectable first principles arguments for term limits. The problem is that when you implement them in a way that seems focused on the here and now, that seems focused on the makeup of the court today, and that are not designed to leave the current makeup undisturbed, then it does seem as if the proponents of these proposals are really focusing on solving for what they see as the short-term problem and not addressing a long-term structural consideration. And Dan sort of raises the question of how are we going to get to a place where we can reach some sort of resolution. I think historically the way we've done that is through the battle of ideas. Look at the rise of originalism and textualism. I think that that was judges and justices winning the battle of ideas, and in particular my former boss, Justice Scalia, really taking originalism and textualism and turning them into the prevailing methodology, so much so that it is now routine, even for nominees by Democratic presidents, to pronounce that they're originalists and textualists at their confirmation hearing. I think we need that battle of ideas, the joining of issue on the merits of legal arguments and theories, to continue. As for Steve's points, I hope that by starting with the issue of funding, that Steve was not launching a defund the Supreme Court campaign. I'm a little bit worried.
Let's all put words into my mouth.
I don't think you seriously were, but I'm a little bit worried that after my next argument, I'm no longer going to get a quill pen because there's not going to be money for it. Maybe I'll get one of those ballpoint pens that the Fifth Circuit hands out instead. But no, in all seriousness, on the issue of legitimacy, I think I completely agree with Steve about one point, which is that the legitimacy of the judiciary is fragile, and it always has been. And there is certainly a sense in which that depends on public confidence in the courts, because, again, the premise of the rule of law is the notion that the public will follow the Supreme Court's decisions, despite the fact that the Supreme Court does not have an army to enforce them, even if they are handed down, as it turns out, in the name of the President of the United States. But to me, that is precisely why attacks that are framed in terms of the court's legitimacy are pernicious, because it strikes me that they are designed to undermine that principle. And of course, that cuts both ways, because if our courts lack legitimacy, they will lack legitimacy regardless of the direction in which they resolve things. And I think, not to put words in Professor Adler's mouth, but Professor Adler's point, I think, was that, you know, now we find ourselves in a place where some view the court as providing protection against the excesses of the executive branch. That is not uncommonly the case when a president of an opposing party is elected. And yet, if you have a court that lacks legitimacy, the court's ability to do that is inevitably going to be compromised. And I would just close on one note, which is that in defending the court against these attacks on its legitimacy, I, and I think others like me, certainly do not intend to suggest that debate about the merits of some of these arguments should somehow be curtailed. As I indicated in my speech at Duke, and I want to reaffirm, we should have debates about what the ethical rules for justices and lower court judges should be going forward. And we should obviously have debates about how the Supreme Court and lower courts decide cases. Indeed, that's what I think we should be doing more of, precisely because it seems to me that if people are unhappy with the outcomes the Supreme Court is reaching, they should be engaging with those outcomes directly rather than casting attacks on the justices themselves on collateral grounds that, in my view at least, turn out to be unfounded.
Anyone else wish to respond?
I guess I'll just say two quick things. So the first, you know, Ken, the sort of, I guess my response to your very last point about engaging with the outcomes directly, I think that completely sort of brushes aside the extent to which I think there are legitimate institutional critiques that have absolutely nothing to do with outcomes. And, you know, I think a really good example of this is, you know, those who have raised concerns about the court's unwillingness to explain itself when it grants emergency relief in high-profile cases. you know, there are examples of the court granting emergency relief in high-profile cases that have benefited Democrats and that benefited Republicans, right? And I think there are folks like me who have been critical of both of those. Not about the outcomes, right? And I think the more that we portray the conversation as being outcome-driven and only outcome-driven, I think the more we are denigrating the notion that there is a legitimate institutional conversation to have, right? I mean, just one other data point, right? I mean, I think it is a relevant conversation why the Supreme Court's docket has shrunk from the 90s when I was in law school. That's ambivalent about, ambiguous about which 90s I'm talking about. From the total number of cases being in the 90s to not even hitting 60 each of the last 5 years, which is the lowest total since the Civil War, right? That's, I think, a relevant conversation and debate wholly without regard to which cases the court isn't taking and why it isn't taking them.
So it'll shock you to hear that the private practitioner on this panel thinks that that's actually the most important subject we should be discussing today. But I don't view either of those things, Steve, as being really a legitimacy critique. And to go to the issue of the emergency docket, on which you may be the world's foremost expert, I totally agree that I think it's a legitimate debate as to whether or not the court should be, you know, writing opinions when it resolves major issues on the emergency docket, whether it should be, as it has been increasingly doing, putting cases on the merits docket effectively by holding oral arguments so that it has more time and space to write longer opinions. These I view as totally appropriate critiques in the nature of critiques about the court's process. And I think it's actually very important that folks like you are shining light on these things, because I think, quite frankly, they are very important at a time when, for instance, it feels like more major issues are being resolved on the emergency docket and fewer issues are being resolved on the merits docket.
Sure. And just really briefly, if I may, just in a short response to Judge Jones, I think we should probably just go get a beer and have a chat. But just briefly, I mean, I think it is worth pointing out two things. One, I have never used the term close to unethical in describing anyone's behavior. My critique is that the rules allow this behavior, not that they don't. And second, I do think that there is a tendency on the part of folks who are invested in one side of these ideological disputes to downplay evidence of the same problems in contexts that are less ideologically charged. And Judge Jones mentioned the patent bar. Well, let's take the patent bar as an example of this. So I think some of you might be familiar with the single judge division that exists in Waco, Texas. Waco, just, you know, for math, is the 23rd largest city in the state of Texas. And in 2021, it was home to 23% of all patent litigation in the United States of America. How did that happen? It happened because the single judge in Waco was really interested in hearing patent cases, and so adopted a series of local rules that made it especially beneficial for patent litigators to file claims with no relationship to Waco, but maybe with some connection to Austin, also in the Western District, in Waco. The blowback against this, the pushback it engendered, was not just from crazy liberal law professors on their blogs. It was from Senator Tom Tillis, right, who joined a letter to Chief Justice Roberts about how pernicious this behavior was. It was from Chief Justice Roberts himself, who in his 2021 year-end report went out of his way to mention how this raises concerns about the appearance of the judiciary. And so I guess I'll just say, like, you know, maybe, right, there are people, and maybe Judge Jones believes I am one of those people, who have ideological reasons for being opposed to this kind of behavior. Seems like the extent to which there are plenty of people who aren't me, who thought this was a problem worth solving in the patent context, suggests that it's not just ideological. Thank you.
I've studied Professor Vladek, and this is a file of his articles, amicus briefs, and tweets regarding the process of judge picking that he criticizes so heavily. And he has said to me once before, and I'm sorry, this is not ad hominem, Professor. It is really about the nature of the comments that are made. But he has said before to me that it is not personal. He doesn't criticize the judges on a personal level. Well, I'll read you a few tweets. November 18th of 2022, someone says, isn't judge shopping a practice as old as the sun? Professor Vladek says, nope, forum shopping is, but literally picking a single judge is a relatively new phenomenon available only in a handful of Karen, primarily red states. Well, I've already said, I'm not, you know, I'll get to this, there's more about this, but as far as the patent bar and Marshall goes, I'm afraid Justice Roberts overlooked the patent bar in Tyler, Texas, 100 miles from Dallas, where judge picking has been going on for nigh on to 20 years. And there was never a word about it until the judge in Waco. That's something. Judge, Mr. Vladek said in, I think, April of 23, just tie these threads together. He mentions a person in the Texas SG's office, and then he says, the then EIC who allowed Kazmarek to pull this nonsense is one of the lead lawyers steering Texas challenges. On another one, he says...
You might note the context in which I said that, which was about something that happened before he was a judge.
I don't think that's the case.
Yes,
I think
it was about a dispute over a law review article that was changed.
You're still saying you're referring to the judge as pulling nonsense. It's part of a pattern. I've just got three more.
I do appreciate Judge Jones making my point about how we're shouting past each other and not engaging on substance.
We're up to three Texas judges who have no problem with Texas judge shopping. Here's Judge Hendricks denying DOJ's motion to transfer. One of the articles Professor
Vladek... What was the attack in that tweet?
One of the articles Professor Vladek wrote is, here, you know, do you know who Reed O'Connor is? It was an attack on Judge O'Connor. This one was Judge Hendricks. Then two more. One is, I'm not aware of any place in the country right now where a Democratic appointee who's even close as far to the left as Kazmarek is to the right. Here's 100% of new cases. And then he says, no, but you're making two, let's see, somebody talking about Northern District of California, 23 active judges or Democrat appointee. What do you say about a 96% chance of drawing Judge Kazmarek? Would that ameliorate your concerns? No, but you're making two assumptions that I very much dispute. First, that every D appointee in ND California is as far to the left as Kazmarek is to the right. Karen, I'm not sure any of them are. I'm quite confident not all of them are. And second, that they'd all rule the same way, which if that's not an attack on the character of the judge, I don't know what is. And all I will say is the consequence of all this is Judge Kazmarek is under 24-hour-a-day protection. He has five kids. Someone has been indicted for a death threat against him.
I'll just say, Judge Jones and I have very different definitions of what a personal attack is. And, you know, I suspect she would not count the last 5 minutes as one. But it's worth stressing that what I have done and what I've written, and I don't delete my tweets, I will stand by everything I've written, is describe a pattern that is happening. It is objectively true that Judge Kazmarek hears 100% of civil cases filed in Amarillo. It is objectively true that that is different from a district court, whether it's the Northern District of Texas with Republican appointee or the Northern District of California with Democratic appointee, where your odds of drawing a judge appointed by a particular party's president are similarly high. And I'll just say last but not least, I mean, I do think that we ought to be able to, you know, understand what language means in this context. I don't think Judge Kazmarek is in any way not qualified to be a federal judge. I've never said he is. I haven't accused lawyers of behaving unethically. I don't think they have. I think the question is, when you have the state of Texas filing 60 lawsuits against the Biden administration in district courts, none of which are where the state of Texas is, i.e. Austin, where the place they file the most often is Amarillo, despite any geographic lack of geographical connection, that's a pattern worth talking about. And if you disagree, fine. We can have that conversation. But the notion that describing behavior is attacking judges, I think, is a very dangerous road to go.
So, Professor, as Judge Jones alluded to, if there is a forefather of J.
judge picking opportunities in Texas, that person is not named Matt Kaczmarek. That person is named William Wayne Justice, who literally moved chambers from city to city to city to city to city to maintain an opportunity for decades for there to be judge picking. The UT, the Academy, of course, does not disparage Judge Justice. He is honored as the named UT Center for Public Service. My simple question is that why you left to go to Georgetown? Because you were upset about judge picking by Judge Justice.
Sure.
I'm just kidding.
I know. I think it's rather unfortunate what's happened this afternoon, and I wish that it weren't so, but I also think that it says a lot about where we are, that instead of having a conversation about whether this is a good thing or not, we decide to turn it into a, you know, can I put words into your mouth that make you look bad? And it seems like that's not the kind of debates that I thought the Federal Society was interested in sponsoring, and I'm disappointed that it's the conversation we've had today.
Well, the point of attacking these judges is to diminish their reputations, to suggest that the state of Texas and other state attorneys general who filed in these jurisdictions are doing something improper. It certainly encouraged a couple of senators who are no strangers to threatening the judiciary, to threaten the legislation and require, you know, push the institutional judiciary to try to change its rules. These are driven by location. So, you know, I urge you all to read Senator McConnell's letter. He points out that there's a district in Kentucky where there's one judge. Now, I don't know why people weren't filing suits in Kentucky or the Sixth Circuit. It's a great circuit. Anyway, I look forward to Professor Vladeck keeping his close attention to the courts of Southern District and Northern District of California during the next 4 years.
I mean, I intend to, and I look forward to Judge Jones perhaps considering that I'm trying to raise awareness of an issue and not acting.
Well, it's not going to be an issue starting in January.
I want to say, if you think that Democrats and left-leaning groups aren't going to try to find courts that are as sympathetic to their challenges as some of the courts in Texas and perhaps the Court of Appeals on which my distinguished colleagues to my left sit, I think that's, I would not bet money on.
I almost hesitate to weigh in.
the water actually, is very warm. Please
actually,
jump in.
Actually, delete almost. I hesitate greatly. But I want to just offer a broader observation about this, which is that I guess I take a pretty benign view of what some refer to as judge shopping, because maybe as somebody who just is down in the trenches as a country lawyer, it's what plaintiffs do. Plaintiffs choose their forum strategically. And I think the reason that this has become such a prominent issue more generally, leaving aside the fact that it's been an issue in the area of patent litigation for now many years, is because of the other phenomena that have contributed to the other subject that Professor Vladeck has studied so skillfully, which is the emergency docket. What we have is presidents increasingly acting unilaterally through regulations or executive actions, critics of presidents, whether it be states or others, bringing suit in an effort to enjoin those actions on a nationwide basis. And precisely because the presidential actions in question have national effects, they can bring suit essentially anywhere in the country. And that is why we have seen that in this administration. It's why we saw it in the last administration. And it's why I'm confident, as Judge Jones says, that we will see it in the next administration. And as long as courts retain this ability to grant relief on a nationwide or quasi-nationwide basis, it puts tremendous pressure on the government when injunctions are entered to seek review immediately and to seek review all the way up to the Supreme Court if necessary. That puts tremendous pressure on the Supreme Court to act on its emergency docket. It's often, though not always, under pressure to act quickly, which I think in part explains why sometimes you don't get voluminous opinions when the court does so. and yet the court is deciding very consequential issues. And one can debate sort of which of the elements of the phenomenon I've just described is more or less problematic, but I think it's a pretty apt description of what's actually going on.
And one might say, worth a conversation about whether we should discuss systemic reforms. For example, right, limiting nationwide relief or requiring suits seeking nationwide relief to be assigned to three-judge district courts, whether they're filed in San Francisco or Amarillo. I mean, you know, there are people, I happen to know one of them, right, calling for these kinds of conversations in contexts that have nothing to do with who, which president appointed which judge and which president's policies we're talking about.
And I would actually agree in the sense that I just think that now we have evidence that this is a phenomenon that stretches across administration. I mean, we will have had examples really going back to the Obama administration, so now across four administrations of this taking place. And, you know, I'll just note, since I've been focusing on the Supreme Court today, that the Supreme Court is obviously a pretty critical substantive participant in those discussions because of the ongoing debate about the propriety of nationwide injunction.
And so I just want to say that I do think some of this discussion gets back at the point I was making earlier, which is that when we're talking about any kind of structural reform of the judiciary, you know, people are going to have short-term interests. I think you have to recognize that, but I don't think, you know, that means we can't ever have those conversations. And I think that just pointing out that any given person might have something substantive at stake is not responsive. I mean, I think that whether or not Steve has been consistent or inconsistent does not bear on whether his arguments are correct. That is a rhetorical fallacy. And I think that we should be evaluating whether his arguments are good ones or not, and not trying to paint him as hypocritical. I just don't think that is the way to approach these questions.
I do want to give the audience at least some chance to weigh in on this.
Sure. Roman Bueller with the Madison Coalition. You might agree that one of the most serious threats to the independence of the Supreme Court are the variety of pieces of legislation now pending in Congress to manipulate the size of the court, either by forcing people off the court or by expanding the number of justices. My question is, what do each of you on the panel think about what is actually the most widely backed Supreme Court reform in Congress, which is called the Keep Nine Amendment, which simply says the Supreme Court of the United States shall be composed of nine justices, first introduced by a Democrat, backed by more than 200 members of Congress. And for Justice, I wonder if you could associate yourself, would you choose to associate yourself with the remarks of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who said nine seems to be a good number, it's been that way for a long time.
Anyone want to take that one on?
I mean, I'm already on the record as saying that I have a hard enough time arguing before nine. I can't imagine arguing before more, so my position is easy.
Try on bunk in our court.
I'm working my way up to that, Judge.
Ilya Shapiro of the Manhattan Institute, and author of Lawless, The Miseducation of America's Elites, now available for pre-order. So it's one thing to talk about technocratic governance reforms, like what to do about universal injunctions, should we increase the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction, should we split up the Ninth Circuit because it's unwieldy, the judges can't read their own opinions. That all is well and good and technocratically important. But maybe I have too much sand in my ears from having my head in the sand, but I still have not heard what is the problem to be solved with structural reforms of the court, given that its popularity is very high relative to other institutions at a time of low societal trust, given that its public confidence is higher than it was the year before Dodds was decided, and that the only problem seems to be the polarization, the historic difference in those on the right, those on the left viewing it, but that seems to be a broader function of everything going on in society more broadly. So again, what is the problem that we are trying to solve with any sort of these so-called reforms?
But I'd say the answer depends a little bit about your predictions about the future. I think my argument, and I think this is implicit in what Steve was saying, is that the trajectory might be in a certain direction that's dangerous, that the court's legitimacy and popularity certainly is higher than say, Congress's right now, and that's been true for a long time. It has nonetheless declined, and I think both he and I are concerned about a world in which that trend continues, and important parts of the country and, you know, blue state governors decide to try to stop following Supreme Court decisions, all sorts of things you could imagine that are problems down the line. Maybe that doesn't happen, and maybe some of those problems don't materialize, but I think those are things that we should be concerned about in a way that didn't really seem realistic a decade or more ago.
I'll just say, I mean, I think for me, the problem that I see is a court that is not and does not believe it ought to be accountable to the elected branches of government. And that's not just my view. I mean, if you just take what Justice Alito said to the Wall Street Journal in an interview last July, he said, quote, "I know this is a controversial position, but I'm willing to say it. No provision in the Constitution gives Congress the power to regulate the Supreme Court, period." So leaving aside that that's not true, Article 3, Section 2, Clause 1 expressly gives Congress the power to, quote, "make regulations," unquote, to the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction, it also misses 180 years of history in which Congress actually regulated the court in lots of ways, big and small, some of which I mentioned in my opening remarks. And I think part of the problem today is that the court today does not worry about Congress at all, right? That the court's docket has shrunk because it faces no pressure from Congress to take certain categories of cases that used to be its bread and butter. That the justices' behavior, whichever justices float your boat, right, faces no meaningful scrutiny from Congress, whether through formal investigations or otherwise. And so, you know, it just seems to me that there is a history of the court being more accountable to Congress and to the executive branch that we don't see anymore, and that is, I think, exacerbating the growing polarization that Dan mentioned. And so the reforms that I am most principally behind are reforms that are not about limiting the court's power, that are not about changing who the justices are, but rather are about sort of modest, I mean, almost, you know, milquetoast ways, right, of restoring even a modicum of interbranch dialogue and congressional accountability. Thank you.
Steve, can I maybe just mildly dissent from what you just said in a couple of respects? I mean, I do think that the court has been reasonably responsive to some of the recent critiques, and maybe it's not being responsive to Congress per se, but I think one example is that in light of the light that you and others have shed on the emergency docket, we have seen the court moving more cases onto the merits docket, and I think that that reflects some degree of awareness of some of the critiques that have been raised. And I also think significantly that the court's recent adoption of a code of conduct, while perhaps not going as far as some of the critics of the court might wish, was probably responsive, at least in part, to the threat of Congress weighing in and imposing ethical rules on the court, which may or may not be constitutional. And so, I do think that the court is aware of the criticisms at some level. Now, will the court go as far as some of the critics would like? I suspect the answer to that is no.
So can I just briefly say, I agree with that, right? And the only thing I would just add is, but if the question is accountability to Congress, right, acting without, right, the sort of preempting doesn't necessarily reestablish that, really. That's all.
Thank you, Judge Newman.
Yes, thank you, Judge Ho. And I'm Judge Newman of the Court of Appeals of the Federal Circuit. Judge Jones mentioned very briefly that there are things going on. And what I'd like to do is to flag and to outline again very briefly this, what I see as a fresh development in judicial independence, and that is the independence of a judge from removal from service, removal by her colleague. There are procedures for removing judges, but for me, these procedures weren't followed, for my offense is writing too many dissents that are often adopted by the Supreme Court. So my colleagues decided a year and a half ago that I would hear no more appeals, and they acted on this decision immediately. And as those who practiced before the Federal Circuit know, I haven't heard an appeal since March of 2023. So my colleagues have silenced my voice. They've silenced my views on technology, on industrial innovation, on veterans' rights, and the areas in which the Federal Circuit has exclusive appellate jurisdiction. So, of course, I'm fighting, not just for myself, but for the integrity of the judicial branch, as we've been discussing, the integrity of the public's confidence in an impartial judiciary. And in this, I am fortunate in being represented by the New Civil Liberties Alliance, led by Greg Dolan, who's here. We asked the district court to review a constitutional aspect. We asked for congressional hearings. We asked the judicial conference to intervene, and so far, without success. And this situation raises a host of issues of the sort that the panel has been discussing, issues of checks and balances, of course, the Constitution, and particularly now, as I see it, the issue of where is the oversight of a court's internal actions. So my judicial independence has been removed by my colleagues. The question is, what does this mean for an independent judiciary, and what can we do about it? That's my question for you.
I was the chief judge of the Fifth Circuit. I had to preside over two matters that led to the impeachment and removal, or one removed by impeachment, one ultimately withdrew in the face of being impeached. There are strict procedures that are supposed to be followed. There is a very serious doubt in my mind, at least as an observer, about what Judge Newman has been subjected to, and since I'm maybe one of the older people in this room, certainly on the bench, I will say it could happen to any of us. And I took a comfort from what Alexander Hamilton wrote in Federalist 78 or 79, where he's talking about term limits. There have been proposals to age out judges at the age of 60. He said he had found no evidence that mental decline necessarily has anything to do with age. And he said the concerns about a superannuated judiciary are not to be taken serious. And that's my comment about Professor Epps's deal about lifelong. I'm sorry we're living longer, but... Yeah, that's the way it is.
Unless any other member of the panel has comments, we've run out of time. Let me close with a couple of brief announcements before we wrap up that I've been instructed to deliver. First, if you are pursuing CLE, please be sure to check out by scanning the QR code that you had scanned when you checked in. I assume you all know what that means, because I don't. Second, we encourage anyone who wants to have conversations here to do so, but to please do so outside this room so that folks can close down this area for the evening. That would be most appreciated. With that, would you all please join me in thanking our very excellent panel today. It was a tough discussion, but hopefully a good one.